Welcome to Disrupt Disruption, a series of intimate interviews with global thought leaders and practitioners operating at the intersection of business, leadership, and technology. We're discussing all things innovation and disruption and how to not only survive but thrive in these times of exponentially accelerating change. Trusted by CEOs, founders, and leaders globally for the latest take on business models, methods, culture, and leadership, we cut to the chase, debunk the hype, and get real. You're in great company. I'm your host, Pascal Finette, co-founder of Be Radical. Hey, everybody. Pascal here. Another episode of Disrupt Disruption. Today, we have Chris Clearfield with us. I'm super stoked about this conversation, and stoked is the right word to use here because Chris helps leaders solve impossible problems. He works with engineers, software developers, attorneys, and C-suite executives. As a coach and consultant, he guides them to a deep understanding of their unique and complex challenges. And with his assistance, they learn to engage others and solve their most challenging problems in creative, collaborative ways. Chris is the co-author of Meltdown, What Plane Crashes, Oil Spills, and Dumb Business Decisions Can Teach Us About How to Succeed at Work and at Home, which was named a best business book in 2018 by the Financial Times and won the National Business Book Award. His work focuses on risk, strategy, innovation with leaders at some of the world's most interesting companies, from major oil producers to tech companies like Microsoft and Etsy. He also runs his own podcast, which I highly recommend. It's called The Breakdown. You'll find it wherever you find your podcasts. Chris, super stoked to have you here. Welcome.
Pascal, the feeling is mutual. I'm super excited to talk with you.
So my first question always is, because disruption, the core topic of our podcast, of course, is so ill-defined or so, I don't know, it's like a sponge, like everybody just uses this for whatever they want. I'm curious, how do you think about disruption? Where do you start?
Yeah, well, I think there's the classic, we were talking a little bit about this as we just chatted to warm up for the show, but there's the classic kind of Clayton Christensen innovator's dilemma. Disruption is offering something that's worse but cheaper and kind of disrupting a marketplace. But where I actually see disruption, I think, come up mostly for the clients I work with is where they are being disrupted. In other words, the activity systems they have, the strategy they have, the way they have gotten things done for years is no longer enough for the complex, dynamic, fourth industrial revolution world that we live in. And so I really think of disruption in the kind of broader context of something to respond to, rather than the kind of narrow context of here's what it means to be this kind of specific kind of innovator today.
And as a leader, how do you react to it? How do you prepare yourself for it? Or is it purely reactive?
Well, I think that's the whole crux of the thing, right? So the whole crux of the thing is that if you keep doing what you have done for decades to man. I work mostly with bigger companies, although some with smaller firms too. But if you're a big company and you're operating now in the same way that you were operating 20 years ago, you will necessarily be in a reactive stance, right? Because the world is just moving so much faster. But I think the opportunity for a leader is to really, in a real fundamental way, reshape the way that you run your teams, reshape the way that you run your organization, reshape the way that you engage with problems and create possibilities. And I think software is an industry that has done this kind of early. They were sort of a leading indicator of this, where we had the switch from waterfall development to agile, and everybody kind of knows that story. And now everybody wants to be agile. But I think what's missed in that story is, on a kind of deep level, like how much of a fundamental shift that was in the way that people operate together and the way that people talk and the way that people discuss mistakes and problems. It's really a fundamentally different way of thinking about the world. So it's an acknowledgement that the world is complex and that we can't operate as effectively with our kind of old style linear tools in that complex world.
So as a leader, what would you recommend I do? I start to see that, and I start to acknowledge the fact that my organization might not be quite as equipped for the complexity we are facing today. Where do I get started?
Well, and this is what I think makes this work so interesting, in that it's work that is also deeply personal, because I think the way to get started is to acknowledge that you don't know the answer. And that, for a lot of the leaders I work with, that is a big first step to take. And so one of my roles as somebody who's consulting with leaders, someone who's coaching them around change, is to just start with that, is to start by supporting them in their own journey to move from an expert-driven stance where their job is to be an expert, an engineer, developer, whatever, and their job is to know the answer, to a stance where their job is to be, to kind of take off their expert hat, still tap into the grounding of the expertise, but to take off the expert hat and to realize that their job as a leader isn't to come up with the answer, it's to ask better questions, it's to engage openly and freely with people, it's to be of service to the organization in how you help define these things. And that's part of the journey to go from being reactive to being, and I won't even say proactive, adaptive is probably the right dichotomy there, the right polarity. So a big part of it is just that first step internally to realize that if your job is to know the answer, then you'll always be in a reactive stance because you can never know the answer to the thing you don't even know is coming. But if your job is to create a team that has adaptive capabilities, then it's a different stance. But that first step is that kind of getting the support that you need to take that leap and to work with that uncertainty in a courageous
way. What do you think is necessary on an organizational level to create the conditions for that? It sounds like investments we need to make into our people to make them adaptive. Presumably, it's not just enough to like walk into the office tomorrow and say, I don't have the answers anymore. I have a bunch of questions for you. What do you think are the necessary investments on the organizational scale which need to be done to become ready as an organization to thrive in complex?
Well, I think that what's coming up with me is this idea that you've got to start somewhere. So you're right. You can't sort of snap your fingers and turn things around overnight. But you have to start somewhere. And I think you have to realize that, yes, there are problems for which the right tool to apply kind of deep optimization, right? It's lean, it's Six Sigma or 12 Sigma or however many Sigma you want. And you're just trying to sort of squeeze the sponge to get as much out of things as you can. And then there are these other problems where, and these are the phrase impossible problems. I mean, I think of those in a very specific way. I think of them as problems where you don't know the answer, you don't control the people, and you don't control the context, the overall system, the incentives, the regulatory structure, the organizational structure, all of these things. So I think in many ways, a first step is to really start by figuring out, well, what are the important problems that we have, that we have tried to solve in the old way that we haven't? And how can we go after one of those in a way that will help us start to build our adaptive capacity, that will help us start to build our muscles, because it really is a muscle. Maybe a sport is a better analogy. I'm not a big sports guy, but I think in many ways, one of the things that's happening in organizations is we're going from having organizations who play baseball, where you've got people in sort of fixed positions, to organizations that play total football or soccer, where you've got this really fluid kind of interplay on the field and anybody can be in any position. And that's the adaptive organization. And when you take people that have trained their whole careers to play baseball and you put them in this new environment and you're demanding new things from them, it's going to take a lot of, you know, time and effort to make that transition. But I think choosing a real meaty problem to go after where you're explicitly recognizing as a group that, like, hey, we don't have the answer for this, but we have some questions and we want to spend some time really understanding the problem and understanding people's experience of the problem rather than jumping towards solutioning and saying, well, this is what we're going to do. I think that's you need to start somewhere. And so picking a place to start is a good idea.
If you wouldn't mind, I would love to zoom out for 1 second because a lot of your work, and I'm super stoked to have you to say the word again on this podcast, because we haven't had an expert in this field of complexity and complex systems. Yeah. And I can't tell you how many times I have heard the acronym VUCA being thrown around by people. And everybody likes to use it. Some people can even tell you what the acronym stands for.
Right.
But I always wonder if people actually really understand this. As an expert, actually think about complexity. How do you make it understandably?
Yeah.
How do I operate in this environment?
Well, and I'll share with you a learning that I had, which is writing a book about complexity and then having it land in the marketplace. One of the things I realized was, because my plan was to write the book and then like just have my phone number on the cover or whatever, and then people would start calling me. And that didn't happen. I mean, it did to some extent. We managed to do two things. We managed to advance a serious theory and get read by some business people. So that feels important. It feels like it had an impact. But what working with the book made me realize was how for so many leaders, complexity is often my starting point. But for most business leaders, it's not their starting point. They don't wake up in the morning thinking, I have a problem with complexity. They wake up in the morning thinking, gosh, I wish we were faster at our maintenance program, or I wish we could innovate more, or I wish we could do XYZ better. And so a big part of my work has been recognizing that complexity isn't always the thing that resonates with as a starting point. And that was kind of humbling, right? Like having written a book about it, thinking it's this very important thing, and then having it not land in a universal way that I had hoped. That was a humbling experience, but I learned a lot from it. And one of the things I learned is that we actually don't need that big of a definition of a complex of complexity, right? We don't have to be that rigorous about it. I mean, there are physicists that spend their careers defining and working with the mathematics of complex systems. That is not very useful for someone who's a VP at a big oil company or in the legal department of Microsoft or a technologist somewhere. What they need to know is that the kind of primary definition of complexity that I often work with is that, like, you have a problem and you don't know the effect that the things you're going to try are going to have on the problem. So you might think, oh, we should change XYZ in our organization. And the kind of old school way was through this sort of strategic planning process. And in a year, we're going to do this. And this is going to be our market share and da, da, da. The new way to think about it is, I think, to say, well, we actually don't know what the consequences of this change we're thinking about are. And as soon as you're in mindset, then fundamentally, you have a complex problem that you're working with. And for me, that's the kind of definition that I just try to go back to, that is just really baseline, really simple, ironically. And also, one of the things that I'll use the phrase fight for, like one of the things I fight for kind of on behalf of the organizations I'm working with, is that the antidote to complexity isn't simplicity, because there are many aspects of our system we just can't simplify. We have these global supply chains. We have all of this stuff that we could talk for hours about that leads to the kind of unintended consequences being the dominant force. But what we can do is we can inject transparency into our system. So if people know what they're working on, if they know what other people are working on, if they really have a strategy, not just where they want to go, but how they want to get there, and they're willing to experiment and iterate, like now all of a sudden you're in this regime where you've kind of, back to your earlier question, you're starting to build your adaptive muscles. You're starting to operate in a different way. And I think that's where the power of a useful definition of complexity comes.
And in this context, looking at the common pitfalls, what do you see with probably your clients or generally in the market? What are the things companies and their leaders ultimately stumble over?
I'm going to give an answer, and I don't know if it will be satisfying, so you can let me know, which is, it's really unique for every organization. And every organization is perfectly set up to do what they're doing now, right? They are perfectly set up to operate in the way that they're operating now. And every organization has superpowers, but those superpowers are also their blind spots and their weaknesses. So one of the things that I look for is when I'm undergoing a change process, because this is really all about change, right? We're just talking about, like, okay, we're doing things in way A, it's not working like we'd hope. The marketplace has changed. We need to do things in way B. We're not competitive. We're not innovative enough, whatever. We want to switch regimes. And that's a change process. And so one of the things I'm looking at when I'm working with groups who are trying to guide their organization through a change journey is, well, what are the things that come easily to the way this group operates? Because that's probably what's going to come easily to the way the organization operates. And it's going to be something that's been really, really effective, getting them, making them really, really successful at operating in way A. But unless they can loosen their grip on that, then it's going to be hard for them to transition into a new way of working. And so just one example, I worked with an organization, big oil company, just like super sophisticated oil and gas engineers, people that had like deep operational experience. And one of the things they were really good at was showing data to other people. So they would they had a lot of good data and they could show it to people. And what they were finding is when they were doing this, they were getting a lot of resistance from the people that they were showing the data to. And they would ask for, you know, them to come back and slice the data in different ways. So what would it be if it were on a Thursday and it was cloudy that day? And then they'd go away and do that. But really what they were meeting with was just resistance, right? People either didn't understand the issue, didn't like what they were doing, or didn't trust that this group that I was working with kind of had the best interest at heart of the operational units they were trying to influence. And so you can see that it's really useful to be really good at showing people data. But if that's the only thing you can do, then you're going to keep operating in that regime A. And so a lot of our work as an organization, or with me, with their team, so they could change the way they worked in the organization, was just trying to help them engage in a different way, trying to help them show up and say, hey, we have some data. Here's what we're seeing. How does this problem show up for you? What do you see with this? So kind of going from, I think about it as like, if flipping it from you're going to do you have a 55 slide PowerPoint and you have 5 minutes of Q&A at the end, to you have a 5 slide PowerPoint and you spend 55 minutes in a discussion with people. Well, that's a very different skill set, right? It's a very different thing to do. And you'll notice that it also requires this movement towards uncertainty and this movement towards asking questions instead of telling people the answer. Now, you need both of these things. But to go back to your question, the red flag that I look for aren't so much these kind of universal red flags, but it's more like, oh, what is this organization really, really good at now? And what are the ways that if they want to change, their being good at this thing kind of starts to impose a cost if they want to change?
I'm curious, if you're thinking about companies at large and thinking about the change being instigated, one of the common comments we heard on this podcast is very often people tell me, well, it really comes down to if the CEO, the board, whatever, quote unquote, senior leadership isn't fully on board, if they aren't willing to do this, it is futile. And then I heard every once in a while, I hear people who are saying that might be, but you can also achieve a lot from the bottom up. I'm curious from your perspective, do we need the top leadership in the organization to be fully bought in? Is there a way for us to do this guerrilla style on the ground? I'm curious, how can we quote unquote save organizations?
Right. Well, I think it's both and, right? You need support from the top leadership of some kind, but you need them to, what I often talk about is that one of the mistakes that people who are trying to create these adaptive cultures or just trying to solve a particular problem in an adaptive way, one of the mistakes that's easy to make is to make the mistake of going too quickly to solutions, to solutioning. Because what you really want to do is you really want to get people to understand the problem in a deep and kind of compelling way. And that goes with senior leadership too. Senior leadership might introduce, hey, we want to make this change. And they might delegate, okay, how are you going to, we need you to set up this ERP or we need you to do things in a different way. But if you're not going back to them and kind of cluing them in, say, hey, here's the problems that we're seeing. Like, as we study this in more depth, here's the problems that we're seeing. You might be able to get their support for a narrow solution, but unless you get them to really understand the problem, you're not going to be able to get their support to help you change the way you work and change the way you operate. So I think there's an interplay between the willingness of senior leadership to move forward with something or to create a space to do something. But there's also, you also have to have this feedback loop from the people that are making the change. The more uncertainty you're putting in front of them, the more support you're also giving them, right? Mm-hmm. Because senior leaders are people too, right? Just because you're the CEO of a company doesn't mean you're suddenly comfortable with uncertainty. You're still a human and you still got promoted to that point because you were good at solving problems. But as you change to this kind of participatory, adaptive landscape, you have the opportunity to work through your uncertainty as well. So that's kind of half of it. And then I also spend a lot of time coaching the leaders I work with to be more like pirates than navies. And I borrow that analogy from my friend and client, Jason Barnwell, who's at Microsoft. But the idea is, especially when you're, again, back to this definition of complex systems, you actually don't know that what you want to do is going to solve the problem. And no matter how good your document is or how much time you spend with a group on a whiteboard, until you start to implement this in your organization, you're not actually going to know that it's going to solve the problem. So stop trying to implement things across the whole organization at the same time. Find a group that's that also deeply sees the problem, and you might bring them along on that journey. So it doesn't have to be they come to it independently. And then figure out if they're excited to co-create a new way of working with you, co-create a new solution with you. And then once you've done that and you've started to refine it, other people are going to start to notice that, like, wow, whatever it is, these people are selling more. These people are doing their work faster. These people have reduced their maintenance budgets. They've reduced their downtime. They're better at paying down technical debt. Like, whatever the metric it is, other people are going to start to get excited about it. And you're going to have a lot better data on the fact that your solution works. It's not going to be universal. It's going to have to be kind of iterated in every context. But that's something too that I see so many big companies reach for the policy change as a tool. And it's like, sure, we can do that, but like, let's get some real old-fashioned experiments and let's get people excited about this change. And let's work with the people who are, you don't want them to be exceptional, but you do want them to be, like, you do want to work with first movers first, because that helps really make the case.
Allow me to go kind of full circle to something you said at the very beginning when we talked about organizations reacting to the changes in the marketplace. And we talked about reacting. I'm curious, with everything we've talked about and the behaviors you instill in people and their organizational units and ultimately the organizations, is this a game of reacting, or, and what would it take for you to be active, to be quote unquote the disruptor, which clearly a lot of companies strive for? I'm always questioning if they actually can do it. What is your perspective on, can you actually be disruptive, or is this much more of a give and take with the market?
I mean, you can definitely be disruptive, right? But I think the hard thing is, I think in general, so look, we see disruptive companies, right? Amazon, disruptive, Netflix, disruptive. I mean, Google, right? Facebook, very disruptive companies in their respective spheres. But the other thing about all those companies that I just mentioned is that they're all new. They're all relatively new companies. And so if your question is, as an established organization, how can you become disruptive? I think it's really, really hard. I think one of the mistakes I think we make when we think about business in general is, I think that we underappreciate the first mover advantage that big companies have. And by first mover, I mean 50 to 100 years of advantage. So you've got a product line, you've got an activity system, you've got ways of operating, you've got strategies. And the ones that worked last year are probably going to work this year too, for a long time. So, I mean, even thinking about something like making cereal or processing chicken, right? I don't know how to start a chicken processing company. I don't know how to get chicken to people. It'd be like a big lift for me to, like, if I were really passionate about chicken, like, man, maybe I could do it. And I could get a group of smart people together and I could get funding. But the pre-existing chicken companies have a huge advantage. And I think the thing that's really interesting about the broader complexity of the world is that that advantage is going to last until it doesn't. And so that moment, I think, is very, very hard to predict. I think it is very hard to predict when you have this kind of global regime change from, oh, things are done in way A to things are done in way B. So I think a lot of companies have a really nice competitive buffer around them, which means that they don't have to adapt as quickly as they might if the marketplace were kind of more as we think about it in classical economics. Like, there's lots of barriers to competition. There's lots of barriers to entry until there aren't, right? And so that's the thing that's really, really interesting. So can you kind of build this disruption into your culture? I think the answer is yes, you can. And I think the companies that do it, and I'll also circle back to an answer that I started with. It's like, You can't snap your fingers and do it over with the whole company, but you can choose the areas where you're going to do that. You can choose the bets you're going to make, and you can try and make those bets in a more adaptive way.
So in this context, what would you look out for in terms of the changes in the market or in the dynamics of your market? What would you put on your radar? How do I know that the market is changing around me so that I avoid being the now you don't company?
It's a really good question. And I'll say, I don't know the answer, but I'm happy to speculate and play for a minute with you. I think one of the things to look for is there going to be a fundamental change in the business model, right? So if you're an energy company, are we going to see a shift from sort of centrally produced and distributed fossil fuels to electric vehicles? What's the timescale of that happening? I mean, that to me is a really interesting question. How much is a market going from centralized to distributed? There's like lots of questions like that. I think one question is, do you see competitors or potential competitors where they've changed the platform? So, you know, Blockbuster and Netflix is an interesting example. So a fundamental change in the revenue model from you go to the store, you pay to get the video that you want from off the shelf to, oh, now you have a subscription and DVDs show up in your mail. That's a big fundamental shift. And when you see that shift happening, you still have an opportunity to participate in that new marketplace. But you've got to change your thinking. And that's where you're kind of, if you haven't built that adaptive muscle, you're going to be in that reactive mode. I was talking with, Microsoft is a client of mine, but not anyone in this industry. So, or not anyone in this particular area. So I don't have any particular inside knowledge about this. But one of the things I think is really interesting for Microsoft over the past couple of years is they've really gone from a company that sells software to a company that sells a platform. And kudos to them. They really made a pretty big fundamental shift in how they operated. And they did it in a way that from the outside seems pretty seamless. And so now they're competing with AWS, with their Azure, and now Office 365 is a subscription model instead of you pay $150 for Office or whatever. I mean, I think they deserve a lot of credit for being able to make a shift like that. Again, I don't have any particular insight, and there are people who are way more dialed into this, the dynamics of that part of the industry than I am. But it just strikes me that what they did was they saw that things were going in this way that was platformized and serviced, and they made the shift. And so, I mean, that's one thing that I'm curious about. It's like, if you run a business, I do some work in the legal space. And like, if you're a law firm, what are you, even if you're a big, powerful law firm, like, what are you seeing around you? Like, one of the things you're seeing is that people are providing legal services in very different ways. And some of that is actually disruption, back to the classic definition. And some of that is the fact that you've been insulated from competition for a long time, and those, some of those walls are falling down. So I think that's a really interesting thing to look at.
Last question. I'm curious, with that argument, are you bullish or bearish on incumbent organizations at large to be able to manage this, which seems to be pretty seismic shifts in the market due to exponentially accelerating technologies, the weird form globalization is taking on, legislation, rules, et cetera, et cetera. I mean, there's so much happening at the moment. There's so much increased uncertainty in the world. Curious, bullish or bearish on those?
That's a really good question. I wrote a book about large-scale systems meltdown. So you might think that I lean a little bit in the kind of worst case scenario direction. And the truth is I do. But I think what's also true is you don't know the timescale for these kind of transitions. So one of the things I guess I'll say is I think that this last year and a half of COVID, one of the things it's done is it's really made the nature of unanticipated consequences very visceral for people. So people understand in a deep way that we actually don't have any control over things. And I think that that's a lesson that I know I learned personally and applied to my business. But I think that there's a chance, is I guess what I'm saying. I mean, organizations that learn to work differently in the last year and a half, I think there is an opportunity to keep that cycle of dynamism going. I mean, I interviewed somebody on my podcast who's the CEO of a fairly large grocery store chain that's up here in the Seattle area where I am in the Pacific Northwest. And they rolled out online shopping in 6 weeks or something like that. And in the previous world, that would have taken 18 months. So I think that people are really hungry for the ability to operate in this more dynamic way. It's also, frankly, more fun. But it really does. I think one of the things we need is we really need this shift away from a culture where we expect things to go right to one where we think about as companies where we think about everything as an experiment. And I think that's a hard shift to make. And that requires, again, that kind of interpersonal.
Man, I just want to underline your last wise words here, Chris. This was incredible. What a journey into complexity, managing through complexity, embracing better questions. We talk a lot in my company, a lot about asking better questions. Warren Berger's a beautiful book under the same title gives us good indication here. Chris, this was fantastic. Thank you so much for spending time with us here.
Pascal, you are welcome. It was really lovely to chat with you too. Can I tell folks a little bit about where they can find out more about me?
100%, please do.
Awesome. So I talked about this idea of impossible problems. I have a little cheat sheet that you can go to. So if you go chrisclearfield.com/impossible, you can download a little cheat sheet that's like just how I think about impossible problems and what I think three ways to engage with them differently are. And I think your listeners and community might enjoy that.
100%. And we'll put links to that as well as, of course, your book and your podcast into the show notes. So for everybody who likes to click, we'll have them in the show notes. Chris, thank you again. This was fantastic.
Pascal, this was really, really fun.
Hey, it's Pascal. Thanks for tuning in on this episode of Disrupt Disruption. If you want more, check out the other episodes we have on this podcast. Also know that this is part of an effort of us writing a book about disruption. So keep your eyes and ears peeled towards that. And if you liked it, do us a favor. Go on your podcasting platform of choice, iTunes, Google Play, whatever it is, and just like this. There's some weird algorithm thing, which, you know, if you like it, they will like us. So do me a favor, do that. And if you've got any questions, any comments, anyone I should talk to, drop us an email. Easiest email address for me to reach it is p@finet.com. With that being said, thank you so much for listening, and I will hear you here soon.